Welcome to Back Fence Unhinged, a conversational journey through the nooks and crannies of your day, afternoon, or night. You're about to hear a true story from writer, actor, and author Beth Lissick. Then comes the unhinged part. We'll pop open the cork on Beth's story and unearth the unspoken behind the scenes of it all.
Ah, great intro, Frayne.
Thank you, Andrew. How are you doing today?
I'm really good.
Good.
We spend a lot of time outside, but not in each other's homes. I'm curious, are you kind of a stuff haver? Are you a keeper of things,
or
a purger?
No, I'm a purger. I'm a major purger. Maybe 10 years ago, I went through, there was a time before cell phones where we took a lot of disposable camera pictures of each other and real camera, had lots of artifacts, photo artifacts on papers and stuff on paper. Photo evidence. And I put what I wanted into photo books. And I shredded and threw away the rest. And I told some people about that, and they were completely shocked that I would just throw away photos.
Yeah.
And I was like, "What? Why would I keep them though? I don't want to move them every time I move." Every year I pretend like I'm moving in my house, and I clear out my house as though I'm moving. So I get rid of stuff like as though I'm prepping for a move.
Spring moving.
Yeah.
Spring cleaning to the next level.
Yeah.
That's so smart. I should do that.
What about you, Andrew? What about you? So you have a household of Susan
of four.
and your two children.
We got a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're stuff havers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say we've been threatening to have a garage sale for years. It's coming though. I can feel it. It's all in boxes, up against the garage wall. It's so ready.
I've gotten those threatening texts from you about a garage sale. We're threatening to have a garage sale.
It might be this weekend.
Oh, wow. A Sharks and a Jets.
Yeah. I was also, I was an eBay power seller for a long time. So, I've got stuff.
Yeah. And you're holding on to it in case you bring back that career again.
Yeah, with kids, you start to realize you're not baseball kids. Like you don't need the baseball cards. You start records. I think I'm starting to get rid of I think the drum set's next. There's just been a drum set set up in our home for years that nobody plays.
Wow.
So that's going to be at the garage sale.
You have a sad drum set in your house.
It's now just stacked, which kind of looks like we are starting a drum store. But yeah.
What and do people ever come over and go, "Wow, that's so cool! You have a drum set."
They're friends. Yeah, they're friends. It's like a pinball machine.
Right.
If you have a pinball machine, you don't play it unless your guests come over and "Oh my God, a pinball machine." But you're never it's 5 p.m. time to play a little solo pinball in my living room.
Maybe you could start your morning with coffee and a pinball. That could be fun.
Yeah. Maybe I'll swap it for a pinball machine.
That's right. You're trying to cut out coffee, so you start doing pinball.
Because they don't take up any space.
Yeah. We have a very, as I said at the top, we have a very awesome guest with us today. Do you want to do a little intro?
I do. Yes. Beth Lissick is a writer and actor from the Bay Area, currently living in the Hudson Valley. She's the author of 6 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Everybody Into the Pool, and co-founder of the Porchlight Storytelling Series. Mm-hmm. Beth has also worked as a baker, a promotional banana mascot, and an aide to people with developmental disabilities and dementia.
Hi, Beth.
Hey.
Welcome.
We're so glad to have you here today. What about you? Are you a pack rat, Beth?
My husband is, so that makes me also because we live together. he's
pack rat by marriage.
Pack rat by proxy.
yes. But I was just at my mom's house yesterday, and she has all these photos that she moved from California when she moved to New York. And, when you used to get photos developed at the photo mat, and they'd give you doubles or all the bad pictures that you took that were, your thumbs in front of it, or they're out of, and she still has all those. And it's like, there is that thing with throwing photos away. People hate to do it. They can't bear to do it.
Yeah. Right. And yet with our phones,
We just delete photos constantly. You know, it's funny that it's the physical artifact. That's,
I even keep this the envelopes that have the negatives as if I'm ever going to go back and try to like match the photo to the negative.
Negatives are so cool. They're like pieces of art in and of themselves. Negatives are, and I guess Gen Z isn't like gonna ever have. They're not really, I guess, unless you're in, I guess things are coming back though. Like people, I've seen people, younger people, even in high school that have like brownie cameras and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they're developing film.
As a parent of teenagers, I think they like the act of taking a photo, but they don't necessarily get around to the developing. And, you know, it's more the act of it. You know,
well, just it used to be a surprise. Novelty. You know, you took a photo and you did not know and you waited to get it back to see how it turned
you
out.
You got like five good ones.
Yes.
You're like, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Good investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of memories and photos and things, Beth has a really great story to share with us about what happens to people when they age. And perhaps, you know, it's when they age, probably the thing to look at. I bet people, you can address this, Beth, but I bet people look at photos when they start to, when their minds start to decline, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big touchstone to be able to look at those things. And sometimes they recognize themselves and their family members and loved ones, and sometimes they don't. And one day they do, the next day they don't, the next day they do again. You know, it's so mysterious.
Wow. Yeah. So you have a story you want to share with us about.
Yeah. Well, I met Bill in 2018. He was my first client, but the way that I met him was through this agency that I had heard about in New York City that was just for companion care. So it was take the person on a walk, go to yoga with them, you can go grocery shopping and help them prepare their meals. And it sounded really cool. And especially if you live in New York City, just being able to go into anybody's home or apartment is such a big deal.
Oh. Yeah.
So I thought, wow, this will be so cool. I can meet some older New Yorker and hear their stories. And she said, the woman at the agency said, are you up for a challenge? And I was all for it. I said, yes, I'm absolutely ready for a challenge. And they paired me up with Bill, who had been he had been the chief nephrologist, kidney doctor at Mount Sinai.
Wow.
On the upper East Side. And he got diagnosed with frontal temporal dementia at age 58.
Ooh.
And so this is the dementia that erodes all of your decision-making and impulse control. And so it's different in a lot of ways than Alzheimer's dementia. So he had recently kicked a little girl on the streets of New York and started running up as people chased him. He started running toward the Guggenheim Museum, and he ducked into the museum, went up that iconic spiral ramp.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Followed by police now and guards at this point. He was tackled.
So this person was in shape.
Yes. This was the crazy thing about Bill, is that he was in great physical shape because he loved walking everywhere. So, yeah, he ran. They chased him. They tackled him. They brought him down to the police station. They called his brother and sister. I don't know how they ended up at this point getting in touch with them, but they were his guardians. But he wasn't carrying anything on him saying that. But they got in touch with them. And at that point, his brother and sister said he needs to go out with a companion always on the street. Mm. We don't want this happening again. So
this is a real challenge.
Yeah. And also, I don't know how much, it's always interesting, somebody with dementia, because you don't know what they were like exactly before and how much the disease has changed them. But he did not like being touched. And he had what I would say was actual OCD, not just somebody saying, oh, I'm so OCD about this, like really had specific things around cleanliness and being touched. And so walking down the streets in New York City with him was so hard because I was trying to make sure nobody brushed against him, because this is exactly what happened with this little girl where he kicked her. So it was really challenging.
Yeah, because you can't touch him. So you can't like you put can't, your, I can't link arms with him.
Yeah. there were times when I pulled him back when he was stepping in the street and he would turn on me like he was going to hit me. It was really difficult. So, but what he loved to do was go to museums, go to the ballet, go to the symphony. Yes, exactly. Yeah, my safe haven inside the museum. I mean, he donated to a lot of the museums, so his name was on the wall, and we would go into the Met and look at his name on the wall.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
Like, he was really he had been raised on the Upper East Side in a very wealthy family, and so he also had this air of privilege that was like, wow, he was used to getting anything he wanted whenever he wanted it. He spoke four languages. He was the chief nephrologist at Mount Sinai, and he also had a degree in architecture from Columbia University.
Just for fun.
Just for funsies.
Yeah.
So brilliant. When he ran to the Guggenheim, it's like, I'm running to my second home. My name is actually in this place.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he was like, it's a safe place for me to be. So we had a lot of great adventures, but also he would do things like blow his nose really loud during a concert in a church and just toss all these Kleenexes into the aisle of the church. He would skip a 60-person line at Trader Joe's. And, you know, because in the city, I don't know how it is out there, but the lines for Trader Joe's are super, super long, and they're managed, you know, by the staff. Okay, you're next. But the line could be 60 people long, and he would walk right up to the front, and people would get so angry. There were a lot of challenges. One time we got 86th eventually from the opera because we went to go see Tosca and somebody sat in front of him, as you do in a theater in your seat. He started just kicking. He wouldn't stop kicking.
Like
violently kicking the seat.
So kicking was one of his things that he liked.
Yeah.
He liked to kick.
So we were escorted out of the opera.
How was that for you in that moment?
Like, it was so difficult because I knew that he wanted to be in these places because it made him feel normal and like the things he used to do. But also he was disrupting everyone. And he looked perfectly great. He was very nice dresser and very well groomed, you know, always had his nails and hair and everything. And so it was so difficult because I would have to tell the people like, okay, we'll leave, but don't touch him. And I would have to be saying, Bill, stand up. Bill, we're in the middle of the ballet or the symphony. I mean, finally, we stopped going to those things because it was just too stressful. And the opera never went back. But one day I showed up at his house and at his apartment, and he always would meet us in the lobby, all of his companions. And he opened the door and he looked like he hadn't slept in days. And he held out his arms and he had been just vigorously scratching at himself so much that he was bleeding, not, you know, bleeding out in an imminently dangerous way, but just really awful. It was a lot. It was really disturbing. I felt really bad for him. And he looked so confused. So I went inside his apartment. I said, Bill, let's just hang. He was just wearing his underwear, which he would do a lot later on. Just sometimes he would also just take off his underwear and put it in the dryer just so he could wear some warm underwear. So then he'd walk around kind of Winnie-pooing it for a while.
That seems like a good habit, honestly.
Yeah. So he put down a paper towel for me to sit on the sofa. And I called the social worker who worked with him. I called his brother and sister. And basically the idea was like, he can't go into an emergency room. It will be terrible for him. Just try to calm him down. Yeah. Try to get back to a normal routine. Mm-hmm. So I kept trying to get him to go to the diner for a burger, which is what basically the only food he would eat was burgers and egg McMuffins.
Oh my gosh.
And we go outside. So I spent 19 hours in his apartment before he would leave.
19 hours?
I slept sitting up. I realized it was near the Christmas holidays and no one was there to relieve me. And so I finally got him out. We walked down the street. It was a few blocks from his apartment. We walked about two blocks. And all of a sudden, he took a left-hand turn and peeled off and walked right into the emergency room of the Mount Sinai on the lower, on the Upper West Side, not the one he worked at, but the one near his apartment. And he showed them his arms And I told them what had happened. And the next thing I knew, they had taken him. And he spent the next 3 weeks in the psychiatric ward.
Oh, wow.
And there he was, you know, so then my job was to visit him there. And there were his former colleagues were there visiting him and talking to him. And it was so sad and upsetting. And so at that point, they decided he needed somebody to live with him. So he had to change his apartment from a one bedroom to a two bedroom in the same building. And this is so New York City, I think. They hired a company that specializes in moving people with memory issues into new locations, trying to replicate exactly what their home looked like. So they took a million pictures. They did. They laid his Rolex out on a paper towel the same way that he had had it laid out by the front door. So they had his shoes all lined up the way that he would have them. The weird thing they did is he had a calendar that he was really obsessive about, which happens a lot because people are always afraid they're going to miss something. And they had left it on the day that it was when he went into the hospital. And I was like, I think you should turn it to the
day.
Like, that's so confusing.
This is,
you know?
This is almost like a Black Mirror episode.
Right.
You know, it's literally a mirror of his apartment.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? It was a mirror because it was on the opposite end of the floor. So instead of looking out toward the river, it was looking out toward the park, and everything was turned around and flip-flopped. So it was really confusing. And the first time I went with him there from the hospital, we took a cab, we went back to his apartment, and he got out of the elevator and he took a left like he normally did. And the social worker had told me, no, you just have to say, Bill, this is your apartment. This is your apartment. And so I kept saying, oh, it's actually this way. So with people with memory issues, like most people know, if it's not anything too important, you can just go along. If somebody says, oh, I was just at work yesterday as teaching my class, you don't say, you retired 25 years ago. You're not a teacher. You know, you just kind of go along with it, right?
Yeah.
So they were basically having me gaslight Bill about the apartment because they thought that he couldn't handle knowing that he had been moved. But to me, it was like, whatever he's taking in at this point, we have to tell him that he actually is right. His apartment used to be over there and it's not anymore. And so he would get up really fast and walk. I would get him into the old apartment because I'd show him his stuff. I'd stand at the end of the hall and say, hey, look, you know, here's your hat from the time you went to Italy or whatever.
Right.
And he would come over and look around as if he was just in a whole other dimension, because it must have felt, and plus there was this second bedroom in it, you know. So he would rush out the door, go down to the other apartment, bang on the door, and he would do this after somebody had moved in. And he was in danger of getting kicked out of this apartment. He had already been kicked out of other apartments because his behavior was so wild. So he couldn't get kicked out of this place. We had to try to keep him from doing this. And it was impossible. So finally, one day, he stopped doing it. And it was such a relief to not have to chase him down. It had gone on for weeks, but when he stopped doing it, it was such a relief. But it was also sad in this way, because it was like, wow, he has either forgotten that that was his apartment, or he doesn't have the energy anymore to fight it and to go back. And that was the beginning of a whole new era with him, where he was with somebody around the clock and we were sleeping there, and it opened it up into a whole other form of caregiving that I never thought that I would be doing, when I thought I was just, you know, going to the symphony.
You're going to be going to yoga with people.
Exactly. Exactly. So that was a particularly trying time for me as a caregiver, to have to lie to him in this way that I felt like was not serving him. And I eventually did just break down after a couple of days, and I had told him, okay, but I don't know, you know, you never know how much someone is understanding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
but at least like you were kind of clearing the ethereal energy of that, I think, in some way by telling him.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt better to just be honest. 'Cause I do think that people pick up on your signals, of course. And if I was looking at him being really frank and open and honest, he could tell that it was a different a different way of communicating than an anxiety-ridden, no, no, your apartment's over here. Let's go this way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mary Poppins. Yeah. You're like Mary Poppins telling somebody the wrong thing. It's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this was your first time, which, by the way, a hard landing into this job, I think.
Right. Yeah, he had gone through a lot of companions because it was difficult. And I think because it was my first time and I had a brother with disabilities who had recently died at that time. And so I felt like I wish that my brother could have had somebody like me. Oh. He lived on the other side of the country and it was different, you know, being a sister, but just like a pal, a friend to go around with and make things easier. And so I just was really committed to going all the way with Bill. And I did.
Yeah. Right.
And so with Bill, like, you know, you've told us this part of this story of the, you know, kind of this first companion, but I'm curious about like, what were like some of the lucid moments like with him? The more lucid times, or were there those moments?
There were times he really started to lose his vocabulary shortly after I started working with him. But there was a time that we were riding in the back of a cab to a doctor's appointment, and he said, "I used to work here at the hospital." And I said, "Oh, I know, that must have been so exciting. And did you like the people that you worked with?" And he said, "We would make it in the closet." And I said, "Oh, you mean," and he said, and he just looked at me smiling, and he didn't smile very often. He looked at me and smiled and nodded. And I said, "Oh, so with," they had told me at the agency that he had been bisexual. So I said, "Oh, with men, with women, like who was your person, you know?" And he said, "All of them." So he told me about that. We had moments where we would sit across from each other at the diner with a notebook I had, and I would try to get his story by writing things out. And sometimes he would pick up things in another language. You know, I would look up a word in French or something because he had spoken French, and I would write that word and that would click with him. And then shortly before he passed away, he really went to a really beautiful place where he was just happy. It was the first time I ever saw him genuinely happy and smiling. Wow. We would listen to music, and he was just in his apartment at that time. And so he really started to go somewhere else in the kind of the days or week before he passed away. That was really beautiful. And that I felt like he just was so happy with the companionship and just happy where he was in his apartment.
Oh, Beth, I appreciate that story so much because I think we're so used to hearing about that experience through like a family member's lens, but to hear it from a companion or a caregiver who was really there all the time, and just your dedication is really pretty amazing to hear that story. So thank you so much.
Yeah. I thought that I was just taking that job as another one of my, you know, kind of side jobs that I do to supplement my income. And I just found that I really loved the one-on-one relationship part of it. It was just, it feels really good. And even though with Bill, it was stressful a lot of times, but now I just have so many laughs thinking about it.
So you've been doing this job since 2018, you said, right? So 7 years now. So that you did not shy away from it after working with Bill. You kept going.
Yeah. I started writing about it. And then that became interesting to me to think about. I have a hard time writing and thinking like, well, what can I say that somebody else can't say? And then I just realized that these experiences were so meaningful to me. And I also feel like a lot of people can do this work who don't know that they could do it, that not just with a relative, but so many of us, you know, do it with our relatives as well. But so I just thought, well, if I can tell these stories about this, then maybe it will encourage other people to try it. And we need it more than ever, and we'll need it more than ever, you know, in the upcoming years. So, I do it now where I live in the Hudson Valley, and it's very different because everybody I work with has a family member that they live with. So it's a little different. It's not like you're the only person with them. You're kind of giving relief to the partner or the child of the person as well.
You know, I'm just curious how it's changed any, you know, perspectives, or have you, in talking about it, been able to change other people's? Because like you just said, like, I hope more people will do this. And just what's shifted for you?
Yeah, I think I've always enjoyed hanging out with older people, but I really, really love it. And I, so that part, it's just deepened that part for me, that I love hearing people's stories. I am trying to be a lot healthier, because I know that I want my, you know, to be able to at least be able to go on walks. If my brain goes, hey, you know, at least be able to get out in the world and move around.
And run to the Guggenheim if necessary.
Yes, exactly. We all know now, just run up the ramp. It definitely has just deepened everything about my life, how I look at, you know, my mom living in an independent living place right now at a retirement home. And I'm more kind of attuned to what her situation is, being widowed and living alone, and the challenges that she faces with loneliness and figuring out who she is now without her, you know, without my dad around and as part of this community.
Well, hey, it's time for Bree's Hot Minute, brought to you by Powell's Bookstore manager, Bree Hogue. So Bree's been listening, and I think is going to have some really interesting book suggestions based on Beth's incredible story.
As I listened to Beth's story, I immediately thought of Annie Hartnett's book, Unlikely Animals. It's a tragic comedy about a woman who returns home to care for her father. He's suffering from a mysterious brain disease that causes him to hallucinate small animals. The main character gets involved in other side quests and mysteries, and I really love this book and recommend it frequently. Another book I enjoyed recently is Abby Jimenez's book, Say You'll Remember Me. It's a romantic comedy where after one epic night of romance, the main character moves across the country to help her mom, who is suffering from early onset Alzheimer's. The book follows the normal rom-com plot devices, but I really like the story of a family trying to keep their mom at home as long as possible. Happy reading. Back to Fran and Andrew.
Thanks, Bree.
Thank you, Bree.
So great.
All right, so Beth, where can folks learn more about what you're up to and find your books and all that good stuff?
Well, I have a very poorly maintained website, like a lot of people, which is bethlissick.com. And then I'm also on Instagram and Facebook still, which is at B-L-I-S-I-C-K. And I try to post when I'm doing things. Right now I am more working. I work about 20 hours a week as a caregiver, and then I am writing a book about my experiences now. So
incredible.
But I do occasionally do reading still and shows, so I'll put those up on social media.
Beautiful.
And then our last question for you that we ask is, what is some kind of petty, seemingly innocuous thing that kind of makes you unglued, makes you feel you get inordinately unhinged about it?
I don't even know if this doesn't even seem harmless to me, because it makes me so annoyed, but maybe it's not innocuous, but I, when a person is exiting an airplane or a bus, the first row goes first, then the second row, then the third row, you empty out of the vessel, in an orderly fashion. When the dinger light goes off on an airplane, or you pull into the bus station, if you're on, you know, transit bus, not a city bus, when people get up from the back and try to bum rush it to the front, it drives me absolutely bananas, because I feel like there's a system in place. The system is, we all file off. Why are you, if you have a, you know, another plane to catch, a connection to make, just say so. Just say, oh, I'm sorry, I've got to get off this plane really fast. But when somebody looks straight ahead and is standing blocking you from getting out of your seat because they came up from the back, that's it for me.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy.
So the whole jumping the line at Trader Joe's must have been really tough for you.
Yeah, exactly. His Bill was probably one of those people. He's probably one of those people for sure. Thank you so much, Beth, for being with us.
Yeah, that was great.
Great.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Nice. And thank you to our fabulous behind-the-scenes editor and producer, Julia Oppenheimer. Frayn Masters is executive producer. Frayn Masters and Andrew Dixon are co-hosts and co-creators. Thank you to musician and frontman for Lost Lander, Matt Sheehy, for creating our theme music. And thank you to Powell Books and Kiln Coworking Space for making this episode and our live shows possible. We recorded the show at X-Ray FM. Find them online, or 91.1 or 107.1. You can find more info about Andrew, Frayn, and Backfence Storytelling shows and workshops at backfencestorytelling.com. Bye.
Bye.